Welcome to Beyond the Sirens, our podcast series designed for paramedics who are called to urgent palliative and end-of-life care situations. The aim of the series is to start a journey together, raising awareness of the holistic and complex needs of end-of-life care.
We want to support you in helping patients and relatives make the best decisions for those who are dying and for those left behind.
During the series, we have drawn upon the wisdom of seasoned experts in this field. We are committed to equipping you with the tools and insights needed to make a meaningful difference to the lives of the patients and those that they love. I am Mary Buttle, a registered nurse with extensive experience in the fields of oncology and palliative and end-of-life care, and a wealth of experience in teaching and training in these areas.
And I'm Tessa Taylor, also a registered nurse. I, however, have been in palliative and end-of-life care for a very long time. So for those of you who've heard of Florence Nightingale, we were classmates. During this time, I have also been involved in teaching paramedics.
Welcome to episode one, exploring palliative and end-of-life care for paramedics. Today, we're going to be looking at the following areas. We're going to consider what end-of-life care is and what palliative care is, and what the aims of palliative and end-of-life care are. I'm delighted to say that we're joined today by Dr. Kath Gaunt and Dan Platt. Kath is a consultant in palliative medicine at East Cheshire NHS Trust, and she works across all clinical settings within East Cheshire, so the acute hospital, community and the hospice. Kath has a very keen interest in palliative and end-of-life care education and developing and delivering simulation training in this area.
And Dan Platt currently works as a fairly newly qualified paramedic within his second year of practice with the North West Ambulance Service in the South Lancs area. While studying at uni, Dan actually took on the role of CPD and training officer for the LJMU Paramedic Society, helping to facilitate numerous training events relating to end-of-life care. He regularly encounters patients who are nearing the end stages of their life, often proving to be one of the most challenging yet highly rewarding incidents.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's great to be here and I'm really glad to be involved with this project.
Oh, thanks, Tessa and Mary. Thank you very much for inviting me to speak. It's lovely to be able to be part of this today.
Oh, well, you're very welcome. For the benefit of our listeners, could you kindly spend some time explaining to us what palliative and end-of-life care are and actually what they mean and what the similarities and differences are between the two?
So palliative care, well, essentially, it's the care and support given to people who have got a life-limiting condition. And that could be a cancer, could be heart failure, it could be chronic lung diseases. But for some people, it may be that they have multiple conditions, multiple medical problems and be increasingly and generally frail. So palliative care is not about what the condition is, but it's about what the needs of the person are and what, you know, what support they require. It's really important within palliative care that we focus on that person's quality of life. So that's, you know, thinking not just about their physical concerns, such as any symptoms they might have, but also sort of any practical, emotional, sort of spiritual concerns that they may have. So I suppose what I'm trying to describe is that really holistic approach to care. So we look at the whole person rather than, just the individual condition that they may have.
That's so important, isn't it, for all of us, whatever our role is, whether we're a nurse, a paramedic, the consultant, you know, even the thinking in the acute setting, even the ward clerk, greeting and meeting people, that we've got to have that warmth and have that holistic approach.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's part of what really attracted me to palliative care, is that you're not just sort of working in silos, that you are trying to look at the whole person and that we work as a really wide team. So for instance, at the local hospice where I work, we've not just got doctors and nurses, but we've got a whole range of different professionals that bring their own expertise to, you know, what the patient's needs are. So We've got physios, occupational therapists, complementary therapists, psychotherapists, social work assessors, child bereavement workers. So there's a whole range of different people, and you know, they'll all get involved as and when is the right time for that individual. But it's not just the individual, it's about what the people around that person need as well. So what their you know, what their family's needs are, what those important, those close to them, their loved ones, those loved ones are really important to the person who may be unwell, but there'll be huge amount of need for those carers and those people who have had to deal with that person close to them getting more unwell, becoming less able, and the emotional effects that will have on the patient and their families. So yeah, palliative care, not just about the individual, but about those all around them as well.
Yeah.
So for me, what I always remember is, as a healthcare professional, myself as a nurse, I can't meet all those fluctuating holistic needs of the patient I'm looking after and them of the family as well. It takes a team approach, doesn't it? And we've all got a role and a responsibility within that team.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
It's about working collaboratively, really. Absolutely. with other professionals. Yeah. Yeah. So, Kath, you were talking about the healthcare professionals that you have working with you in the hospice. And I'm guessing that other healthcare professionals outside of the hospice who remain looking after the patients in their own homes, you know, maybe before they come in for admission, you know.
Yeah, so it's a really good point, Tess. And I think it's important to recognise that, you know, palliative care is delivered by a huge number of people, health and social care professionals across the whole health economy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that could be GPs, it could be district nurses, it could be care workers in care homes. They're all delivering aspects of palliative care. Yeah. And we tend to call that generalist palliative care. So for people who are maybe approaching that last part of their life, they're going to need, you know, they're going to need support from all of those different health professionals. And it's important, I suppose, to think where we fit in, because I've trained in what we would call specialist palliative care.
Yeah.
So we're here really to support and deliver care for those people who may have more complexity to their needs than can be met by those delivering kind of more generalist palliative care. So we're here as a resource and as a support to support the care that is provided by the generalist teams.
Yeah.
So that might be advice around medicines. It might be access to specialist palliative care units like hospices at a time when somebody needs them. But I wanted to be really clear that it's not just specialist palliative care workers that deliver palliative care.
Yeah.
You know, we're all responsible in some way in health and social care for delivering really good palliative and end-of-life care. Yeah.
And just picking up on that, Kath, I was just thinking then about the paramedics, you know, thinking about the years I spent working in a hospice, even though a relative may know or have a grasp that their loved one is going to die, it still is a shock for them at the end, isn't it? You know, they're quite often unprepared for that. So I'm just thinking about the paramedics, you know, who may be called out to a home because the family members panicked. And now the paramedic is faced with this person who is dying in a family, maybe that they haven't even met, you know, and still...
I think that could be the hard... When you're walking into a situation completely cold, I'm often fortunate in that I've had the chance to build relationships with patients and families over a period of time, or at least, you know, have really good access to all the clinical records and the discussions that may have happened, maybe have access to advanced care planning documents. So to go in cold and to be faced with, you know, not just the clinical scenario, but the all of the emotions that are going to be tied up with that difficult situation, and trying to unpick that, you know, in a it's got to be timely, because there might be a kind of a critical event happening, but it's got to be sensitive. And it's a really, you know, I can imagine it be a really tricky path to tread to do that. And they think they do an amazing job at what paramedics have to do to go into those situations. You did ask me at the beginning about end of life care and the differences between palliative and end of life care. So I think it's a really good question, because I think end of life care can mean a lot of different things to different people. Yes. And that's why it's really important to clarify when somebody's talking about end of life care, what do they mean by that? So for some people, they may be talking about somebody who they anticipate is in the last days of their life. But often the term end of life care is much broader than that. So NHS England, for instance, they use the term end of life care to mean care for those people who may be in the last year of life.
Right. Yeah.
So it's obviously it's a much larger time span than that, just those last few days or weeks of life. So it's for people, I suppose, who've got those progressive life limiting conditions that we talked about, and that we as health professionals are maybe anticipating that a person may deteriorate and die over the next year, then it allows us to start the important work, to start planning for that, and to be able to have the important conversations, discussions about what's the priority for those people. Because everyone is going to be different and everybody will have different priorities. But unless we start those discussions in a sensitive way, when a person's ready and wants to have those discussions, then we won't know what's important to that person, and what we should be trying to prioritise for them in that last year of their life.
And I think to add to that, Kath, is that it's all our responsibility to be courageous, to have those conversations, whether we're a generalist or a specialist in palliative and end-of-life care. You know, we all have a responsibility to say what's important to you, what matters to you, and to gather that information and to keep going back and checking in. You know, how do you feel about things now? To make sure we have that complete understanding, because we've only got one chance to get it right. And without asking those questions, how will we get it right if we don't gather that knowledge first?
Yeah. And it could be, you know, you're quite right. It's not necessarily going to be the specialist palliative care team that are best placed to have the discussions. It might be that it's somebody who has known that person for years. It might be their GP, who they've got a really good relationship, or their district nursing team, who they've been seeing, you know, once a week for the last X number of years, that they may feel able to bring up their wishes and their concerns with. And so we all have to be open, I think, to the right time and the right place to have those discussions. And you're right, be brave about it. We know that patients don't always bring these things up unless we give them the opportunity to do so. So opening up the questions and seeing what comes back.
Yeah.
And it may not always be the right time, but you know, we don't have to pursue it if it's not. We can do these things over a number of different conversations if that's what it requires. But I suppose the most important thing is about identifying those people who we do anticipate are likely to be in that last year of life. And there's been a lot of emphasis on that, you know, in recent years, and thinking about kind of the strategic planning around palliative and end of life care, a lot of emphasis around how we can identify those people. Because if we're not identifying those people that may be in the last year of life, we're certainly not going to be starting to have those conversations with them about what's important.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kath, for that excellent information and definitions of palliative and end of life care, and having that discussion of the importance of taking the courage to ask patients those questions. I'm sure it's going to be very helpful to all of our listeners. So thank you for that.
Yes, thank you, Kath. So Dan, coming to you now. Now you've heard from Kath, just share with us what experiences you've had of managing a patient and their relatives as they've reached the end of life. So what happened and how it was for you?
Yeah, so obviously as a paramedic, quite often we come across families, patients who are experiencing end-of-life emergencies. Often out of hours when the usual support might not be in place. One job that sticks with me was not long after qualifying as a paramedic. I was called to a Category 1 incident for a patient which was reported to be in cardiac arrest. On arrival, the patient wasn't in cardiac arrest, but it was clear that he was critically unwell and he was probably in the end stages of his life. The patient had multiple comorbidities going on. He was bedbound in a hospital bed, a lot of different conditions, and he also had a DNA CPR in place. He had quite a long-standing history of heart failure, and he was presenting with similar symptoms in this instance as well. His observations were quite deranged. It wasn't entirely clear to us as a crew what exactly was causing that, but after one of our senior clinicians turned up on scene, we got our heads together and we all came to the same conclusion that unfortunately this patient was in the end stages of his life, and it was probably quite unlikely that anything reversible was going to be able to be done for him in hospital. I think initially I felt quite conflicted as to what the best outcome for the patient was, but working as a team, we came up with this conclusion. The difficulty was that his family were quite persistent in the fact that they wanted him to attend A&E. They believed, despite the DNA CPR and the fact that they'd had conversations with the GP, with palliative care teams in the past, I think the initial shock of the situation and the suddenness of it made it quite difficult for them to comprehend that this potentially was the end of their family member's life. So despite us trying to explain to them that we might not be able to achieve anything by taking their relative into hospital, they were still quite persistent in the fact that they wanted them to go, and they felt that that's what they would have wished for as well. So we respected their wishes. We conveyed the patient into A&E, and unfortunately he passed away a short time later in resuscitation, luckily with his family around him, because we'd explained the importance of them attending, because we knew the severity of the situation. I think for me, I found it quite challenging initially to shift my mindset from actively trying to save a life to allowing that natural dying process to occur. I think as a paramedic, it's really difficult to make that shift sometimes because there's so much focus, especially in your training, on trying to preserve life and using life-saving interventions. So it was quite difficult for me to, and it was quite unnatural in a sense as well to make that shift. I think although end-of-life care is a really common presentation within the ambulance service, it might not necessarily be a common incident for all paramedics because of the varied nature of the job and the incidents that you go to. So I think that skill fade from lack of exposure can sometimes make it really difficult to feel confident in your decision-making, especially when you're quite new within your practice as well. So I think that's definitely something I felt on that job as a newly qualified paramedic. not being familiar with local pathways as well.
Yeah, so Dan, it sounds that it was really difficult, and I can't imagine how you must have felt with that. You know, you said paramedics are trained to save lives, yeah. And it is a huge mind shift. Thinking about it though, reflecting on what Kath has just told us about the definitions of palliative and end-of-life care, would that have helped you in this scenario, do you think?
I think it probably would have, yeah. I think having a greater level of confidence in defining what constitutes right. an end-of-life incident and what doesn't would have definitely made it a lot easier in the decision-making process. And it's definitely something that paramedics as a profession could benefit from.
Can I just jump in, Dan? Because I really feel like that was a really, really difficult situation for you as a newly qualified paramedic to be put in or to be in. And it sounds like you dealt with it absolutely amazingly. And I'm glad you had some support as well from some more senior colleagues, because these sorts of situations, they're challenging and they're difficult for, you know, some of the most experienced clinicians, let alone somebody who's not long finished their training as a paramedic. So you should never beat yourself up for, you know, feeling out of your depth, because I think we'd have all felt quite out of our depth in that situation. It's a really difficult place to be. But it sounds like from what you've said, you thought about all the right things about trying to balance the burdens and the benefits of active medical treatments for somebody who's clearly frail, got a lot of comorbidities, and in your opinion was approaching the end of their life. And these situations where you're trying to balance burdens and benefits, they are really tricky, and the views of the patient, if we can get them, and the views of the family are really important as well. Because what we have to think about is, if this person does die, if this patient does die as he did, how are the family going to be left feeling about how he was cared for, and what's going to be their lasting impression, I suppose, of that last care. And I think it would have been very difficult for you, you know, to have done anything differently, really, considering how, you know, the situation you were put in. I suppose what may have helped is a little bit about what we were talking about before, Tess and Mary, about that advanced care planning and the importance of those conversations before an event like this, so that hopefully patients and families can be prepared that there is likely to be a decline, and it may be something sudden, and there may not be much benefit in going into hospital in that situation. So at least there's already been that kind of preparation and that discussion. And so somebody's expectations then might have been quite different for when Dan was called.
I think Dan's example clearly illustrates the powerfulness advanced care planning can have, and a difference it can make in situations like this, to avoid that conflict you have with family members. If you've had those conversations, they've been recorded and shared and documented, it really does help to process and help to alleviate the challenges in the situations like the ones you found yourself in, Dan.
I think from my experience with incidents since that one, I'd be inclined to agree that advanced care plans, ceilings of care, it's massively useful to us as a profession in aiding our decision making and giving us a little bit more direction and confidence as well, especially when it isn't something that we necessarily come across day in, day out as part of our job role. But I feel like definitely with that situation, communication was a massive factor in it and was really important. It's maybe something that I've reflected on since, and something I've changed in my practice as well. I think it's massively important, as I'm sure you'd all agree. Communication in them situations is key, really.
It really is, yeah. It's you know, how that information shared and how we listen as well to, you know, what's coming back to us from patients and from families. I agree, communication is the key to these sorts of scenarios, and how that's handled makes the biggest difference.
And that's is the word fortuitous, as in that, you know, in our next episode we're going to be talking about the importance of communication.
That's good
skills.
I'm really glad you're going to go into
So Dan, a difficult time, but you know, as Kath said, you handled it well, and certainly having other professionals to help you. Kath talked before about having a multi-professional approach, you know, and which is certainly what you had there to help you. So thank you for that.
No, definitely. I think the importance of a multidisciplinary team's pivotal, especially when it comes to end-of-life care.
Oh, thank you, Dan and Kath, for your really lovely, insightful reflections on palliative and end-of-life care and what it's like to be out there on the front line, as it were. It's been really interesting to hear from you, and I hope that our listeners will be able to take something from this to help to impact on their practice too. So thank you very much.
And thanks, Dan, for sharing your experience. That was really insightful. So thank you.
That's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for letting me get involved.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Thanks very much. I've really enjoyed hearing from Dan and hearing about, you know, the challenges for paramedics on that front line.
Thank you, Kath.
Thanks. So before you go, we've got two things to ask you. The first thing I'm going to ask you is, what's your top tip for surviving a shift? If I come to you first, Dan.
I think it would be wrong of me not to say coffee from a paramedic's perspective. It's powered me through many a night shift so far, and I'm sure it'll continue to do so. So yeah, definitely a nice hazelnut latte.
Sounds tremendous.
Well, I'll raise your coffee to coffee and cake, Dan.
There's no competing with that.
Any particular cake, Kat?
Oh, you know what? We've got this amazing baker in our team, and she just brings in the most divine cakes. I'd say my favourite is a blackberry flapjack that she makes. Amazing.
Oh, nice.
So the second question, Tessa and I want to ask you before you go, relates to your lunchbox. Tessa and I, throughout our training with paramedics, have learned how important food is to those paramedics. So we want to ask you, what's your must-have item in your lunchbox? Kath, let's come to you first.
You know what, I think it's important to all of us in the NHS. Food definitely keeps us going, and I have to say, cake and more cake.
Well, you're very consistent. Yeah, good comment.
And eating cake with your wonderful team members, so you can talk about what's gone on, debrief.
Take that opportunity to connect with one another and check in. Good point. Dan, how about you?
I think as much as I like to pretend I'm healthy, bringing my salads into work, I couldn't get through a shift without a packet of crisps. I'm not fussy what type or what flavour, any type of crisps and a cup of coffee and I'm sorted.
Crisps and coffee, the way to go for you then.
Definitely.
Lovely. Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you. So we hope you enjoyed the first of 6 episodes. Please share your comments via the link in the bio, and we hope to see you in episode 2. We're hugely grateful to the End of Life Partnership, Northwest Ambulance Service and Vista Health for their support in putting this podcast together.
So it's a goodbye from me and a goodbye from Tessa.
Stay safe out there.